So good morning, everybody, and welcome. I realize there's a bit of a bright light behind me, the window. We have sun, amazingly, and most welcome, but I can't quite seem to block it out as much as I would like to. So I'm a little bit fuzzy, but I hope it's not too annoying for you. Welcome to the people who are joining us for Sunday. I'm glad you were able to come. So important, as Remick has mentioned, that we support each other during this time. And I'm very grateful, as I mentioned yesterday, seeing you really warms my heart. It supports me in my own practice. And so together, we help each other. Together, we realize that we really are not alone. We really are not alone. So, let me begin by asking you, can you remember a time in your life when you felt very present, poised, balanced, in the very midst of some kind of exciting or maybe challenging activity? Or can you remember a time in your life when you felt very present for what was happening right around you, and yet also able to see the bigger picture of what was occurring? To remember what it was like not to be caught up and lost in the activity and yet to still fully experience it. That feeling in the body. And maybe just in this last meditation, you felt something like that. That sense, that kind of bodily sense of equanimity is something that we really need to cultivate by bringing our awareness to it. As I mentioned in the meditation, to actually rest in it, savor it. And the Buddhist teachings often emphasize the import of just resting in a positive, nourishing emotion, like loving-kindness, joy. These are not something that we steer away from. And they're also not something we kind of indulge in by trying to grasp at them. But they are qualities, they are experiences that we can actually rest in, deeply experience. And in this way, we begin to kind of cultivate them. Just like we habitually cultivate, you know, negative thoughts by going over them and over them again. Same kind of process, but in our practice we kind of shift. We shift towards what is positive, what is nourishing. I think equanimity is not a virtue that is very well celebrated these days. Passion, power, righteous anger, determination, assertiveness. These are some of the virtues, if indeed we can call all of those virtues, that seem to get most of the press. I've noticed at times we treat equanimity in general almost as a fallback position, kind of like sour grapes, thinking of Aesop's fox. You know, when the fox realizes the juicy target is just a little too high and gives up in kind of seeming indifference, telling herself the grapes were probably sour. We tell ourselves over and over again, just let go. Be calm, be equanimous, even though if the truth be told, we still kind of burn. And of course, that is not equanimity either. As we talked about yesterday, the Buddhist teachings tell us that equanimity is a non-reactive, open, balanced presence that allows us to perceive clearly what is happening within and also around us. And that allows us to respond appropriately with wisdom and compassion. This moral quality, and I think it really is a moral quality because it's something we can choose, something we can cultivate. This moral quality really permeates the Buddhist tradition, starting at the very beginning. Now, I know many of you are familiar with the Buddhist teachings known as the Brahma Viharas, or the divine abodes. And I mentioned that yesterday a little bit. So, just to kind of go over that a bit, the four Brahma Viharas, or divine abodes, are four qualities that we can nurture and cultivate. In the Pali language, they, of course, are metta, or loving-kindness, karuna, compassion, mudita, often translated as sympathetic joy, or the joy of others' success and happiness, and upekkha, or equanimity. I think these are the primary heart teachings of the Buddha. The Buddhist tradition holds that everybody, you, me, everybody, has the potential to cultivate and to abide in loving-kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. All of these capacities are said to be of the heart because they are states, I think, that are deeper and more stable than our thoughts. They are clear and strong when not entangled in our kind of self-centered thoughts. They are stable when not compromised by aversion and craving. Yesterday, we saw that this upekkha, or quality of equanimity, can be described as a firm sense of presence, which does not react but is open, open in the midst of all the winds of our life. It holds for us the wisdom of being completely bright here, aware, accepting, rather than our perhaps habitual tendency to manipulate or to escape. So I think in this way, equanimity is radical. Radical because it is the commitment to stop, the commitment to be present, rather than to get into some kind of imagined place or into some kind of imagined state. And if this pandemic is teaching us anything, surely it is teaching us to stop. We could describe equanimity as a place of wholeness, steadiness, and wisdom. And I think particularly wisdom, because equanimity provides us with the inner stillness and a kind of inner silence to really see deeply what is going on, both within and without. And it frees us, at least for a few moments, it frees us from habitually reacting. And that accepting quality of equanimity is a wonderful power. The Buddha in talking to his son, Rahula, offered the following teaching. And I'm going to read this. This is again from the early text, the Pali text. So the Buddha said to his son, Rahula, develop the meditation in tune with earth. For when you are developing the meditation in tune with earth, agreeable and disagreeable sensory impressions that have arisen will not stay in charge of your mind. Just as when people throw what is clean or unclean on the earth, feces, urine, saliva, pus, or blood, the earth is not horrified, humiliated, or disgusted by it. In the same way, when you are developing the meditation in tune with earth, agreeable and disagreeable sensory impressions that have arisen will not stay in charge of your mind. And haven't we all experienced some train of thought, some past hurt, repeating over and over and over again in our minds? Kind of like an earworm, which will simply not leave, leaving us feeling disagreeable, leaving us caught in pain and caught in our delusion. Bhikkhu Bodhi, a contemporary Theravadan monk and a great scholar, wrote that equanimity protects us from being buffeted by what are called the eight worldly winds. Praise and blame, success and failure, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute. And we all know how this works, right? Success, praise, fame, pleasure, all that can be so sweet. But these warm winds are pretty fickle. And sooner or later, we're facing the bitter winds of blame and failure, pain, disrepute. Equanimity is remaining free of attachment or excessive elation with those warm winds when they come. Because we view those as positive, we want them. And equanimity also, though, can free us from discouragement when, well, I'll say discouragement and blaming, when we're faced with the bitter winds of failure or someone else's accusations. Reacting to these worldly winds, we lose our sense of presence. We lose our sense of being grounded here and now. So when our experience is pleasant or unpleasant, we either grasp it or we push it away. And even when our experience is neutral, if we're not attentive, we just become kind of bokeh. We become kind of, funny, a Japanese word just came to my mind.
Bokita?
Bokita. Spaced out. We become kind of spaced out. It's so easy, isn't it? So easy to lose our refuge in equanimity when the world does not give us what we want. When the challenges of our life are circulating around us, the Buddhist teaching tells us to find refuge in the radical presence that is equanimity. A koan or story from the Zen tradition puts it like this. I kind of like these Zen stories because they're pretty colorful and they're also kind of extreme, as you'll see. The Pali teachings, the early teachings, tend to be a little milder, perhaps. So a monk asked Master Dongshan, "Cold and heat descend upon us. How can we avoid them?" And Dongshan answered, "Why don't you go to the place where there is no cold, no heat?" The monk continued, "Where is the place where there is no cold or heat?" And Dongshan said, "When it is cold, let the cold kill you. When it's hot, let it be so hot that it kills you." Let it be so hot that it kills you. What is this you that Master Dongshan urges us to let die? Isn't it the you that kind of squirms, reacts, starts to self-soothe by overeating, maybe indulging in a drug of choice, or binging on Netflix? Isn't it the you that kind of habitually turns away when it gets too hot, too cold? Dongshan is teaching us and teaching his young monk, or maybe not so young, look at your reaction. Can you put it down? Can you return to a place of equanimity? The Buddha's teachings and Dongshan teaches us that equanimity is accepting each experience just as it is. It is a kind of opening to and a willingness to be with whatever experience life is presenting us at this moment. Dongshan doesn't say it's going to be sweet. Dongshan doesn't say, just suffer through it, gritting your teeth. It's something different from both those places. We could describe it perhaps as a practice of non-resistance and non-grasping, making no reactionary demands that our present moment be other than what it is. And sometimes, you know, I think of doctors and nurses who work in emergency rooms, you know, all kinds of catastrophes rolled in, and they cannot freak out. Equanimity is that quality that allows us not to freak out. Yes, anger, sadness, grief, all those things will be there. But the freaking out, in a way, is like being hit by a second arrow. Equanimity, the practice of equanimity, allows us to avoid that. To be present, alive, fully there. Able to meet whatever life is giving you. You know, as we all know, of course, it's not just the worldly winds that buffet us about, triggering our habitual reactions. Often it's something a little more subtle, perhaps, a kind of self-preoccupation that we kind of get caught up in a story about ourselves, a story that says, I'm not enough. I'm not what is wanted. Or maybe the story is that person perceives me as uncaring, as an idiot. All these kind of stories that limit who we are. And sometimes we even leave our authenticity so that we can be perceived by someone else as a kind of a good person or an agreeable person. The practice of equanimity helps us to step out of those traps because it opens our hearts. It opens our hearts to the loved and to the unloved. It opens our hearts to what is agreeable and to what is disagreeable. Whether that is in the world around us or whether that is within ourselves. I think equanimity and the cultivation of equanimity really is an antidote to clinging and aversion. Dogen Zenji, the Japanese monk in the 1200s who brought our practice from China into Japan, wrote this in his famous essay, The Genjo Koan. Nevertheless, flowers fall with our attachment and weeds spring up with our aversion. Nevertheless, flowers fall with our attachment and weeds spring up with our aversion. And isn't this true? We want something beautiful to continue. This lovely relationship to go as smoothly as it's gone in the past week. This party to not end. This friendship to continue on. And yet, the flower falls. We strive as hard as we can to avoid failure and blame. And yet, weeds spring up. This life is difficult. It's hard to be open and accepting to what you would ordinarily be strongly adverse to. But our effort to do so really brings alive, it actualizes our bodhisattva vows. Our vow to awaken, for example, so that we may free all beings from suffering and help them awaken. Our effort to do so makes us useful in this world. Here's a poem by Rumi that perhaps most of us had heard before, but I think it bears repeating. The Guest House. This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from the beyond. Our practice in equanimity, our training in equanimity, is simply sitting by your open door, inviting life to come visit. Rumi tells us, make sure the many guests are welcome from the moment we see them. Of course, some will take time to get to know, and some we will never like. But we are there to greet them. And of course, at times we may find there's too much. There's too much anger or fear or grief, too much distress. And at those times, we allow ourselves to shut the door for a while, when necessary. Our intention is to be present with life. And at the same time, though, to be compassionate towards ourselves. This is training in equanimity, not a do or die contest. We set our intention to meet with openness and courage whatever appears. Sickness, health, praise, blame, poverty, wealth, happiness, sadness, the stupid idiots on the road, and the sometimes irritating spouse or partner. We set the intention to meet each fully. Yesterday, I mentioned the near enemies of equanimity. We should, in our practice, and in our life particularly, be on guard not to confuse equanimity with indifference. Indifference is a loss of connection. Indifference is a turning away from intimacy, while equanimity rests in the heartfelt connection that balances connection with a clear recognition of the way things are. So indifference is one, as I said, of the near enemies of equanimity. But we could also include in that list passivity, resignation, complacency, even acquiescence to injustice. We need to discern and then transform whatever near enemy arises into true equanimity. Because equanimity is not non-action. Equanimity is the very ground of fruitful, appropriate action. And it is also the field from which we acknowledge what we cannot alter or change. Equanimity allows us to accept what we generally, genuinely cannot control. It allows us to accept the truth of impermanence. For example, the early Buddhist records tell us that the Buddha himself intervened three times to prevent war between two rival kingdoms. But when he heard that yet again preparations were being started for war, he did not intervene, feeling perhaps that war was inevitable. He could not stop it. An illness, traffic accident, the lives and actions of others, a new coronavirus. So much is out of our control. And yet, with the cultivation of equanimity, we can keep balance in our hearts. We can again awaken to the fact that we are a small part of this great dance. And even though we may cultivate a boundless compassion for others and strive to alleviate the suffering that we see all around us, there will be many situations that we are unable to affect. When I was writing this, of course, it reminded me of that famous prayer by the American theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. And we've all heard this before. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change what I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. How do we do this? Well, as I mentioned yesterday, I think our training in equanimity begins with our Zazen practice. One of the expressions that's often used to encourage us in our Zazen is sit like a mountain. Sit like a mountain. So we can imagine one of the North Shore mountains, perhaps, full of strength and great dignity, unmoving and stable. Because a mountain does not react to the howling storms. The mountain does not react to buffeting by rain or snow, does not complain about the bitter cold or endless hot summer days. It is intimate, of course, with each moment. Just like our Zazen. In our Zazen, we never know what will show up. Painful memories, self-doubt, sleepiness, anger, calm, insight, strong sensual desires, boredom, and so much more will just arise and pass on. We sit like a mountain. We practice like a mountain, allowing the weather of our heart and mind to do what weather does. It rises and it changes. While we return over and over again to the steadfastness that we find in this very moment. So in this way, we train our hearts and minds to remain open, soft. We relax our reactivity. Our Zazen practice really teaches us what it's like to have a human body, to live a life shaped by countless causes and conditions far beyond our control. It teaches us that we are not masters of our life, but the recipients of this gift that we call life. It teaches us the beauty and the grace of presence. So this is one place we can begin to recognize equanimity and really see the power of this virtue. And recognizing equanimity in our practice, we set our intention to cultivate it further. Aware of our intention, we work with whatever equanimity we have at that moment, no matter how small. And we do this by returning to the very felt sense of equanimity, as we tried in our last meditation there. Or maybe we use some of the phrases that we practiced with yesterday, or other phrases, like, I open to this moment as it is. I meet this centered and still inside. And may I be calm and spacious. But where the rubber really hits the road is when we're faced, I think, with a challenging person in our daily life. When someone cuts me off or drives dangerously, my practice is to wish that they get to their destination without causing harm to themselves or others. And notice I said practice, because at times I succumb to rather blue language first, or at least angry thoughts. But after settling down a little, I really try to pick up the practice. May you get to your destination without causing harm to yourself or others. When I notice my critical inner voice is activated, pointing out the faults of others or of my own, I try to remember to counter with phrases of well-being for the person I was just critical of, or phrases of acceptance, of phrases of kindness for myself. I'd like to say that hostile thoughts don't arise very often, but when someone takes my parking spot, or the barista is chatting away when I'm in a hurry to get my coffee, or my brother doesn't bother to return my phone calls, I slip. And having some phrases can be helpful. Wishing that person to be well, to be content, to be happy, safe from inner and outer dangers. You get the idea. And I encourage you to make your own phrases to help you at those moments. And of course, there are the times when our friends and loved ones are caught in their own emotional turmoil, caught in patterns of destruction, of destructive behaviors perhaps, and we're powerless to help them, maybe powerless to influence them. And here too, we need to cultivate equanimity. And here too, phrases can help. I love you deeply, and I cannot help you. May you learn to accept things as they are. I care for you, but cannot keep you from suffering. At times like that, I imagine the figure of Kanon, Avalokiteshvara, particularly though the Chinese version, Kuan Yin, who really represents compassion and equanimity together. She hears all the cries of the world, but with a hand often open and outstretched, standing very calm and very balanced, present, willing to hear, perhaps not able to help, but willing to hear. In the Tenzo Kyokun, Instructions to the Cook, another text written by Dogen, there is the sentence that goes like this. There is an old saying that a monk's mouth is like an oven. We should understand this. When I first read this, I thought, right, a monk should not be a picky eater. But of course, it means much more than this. Dogen lived in the 13th century when ovens, as we know them, were not used in Japanese cooking, of course. Dogen refers to, using the word oven here, it's actually the firebox, an oven that uses wood, dry grass, anything that will burn, and then on top of that would be almost like the stove part would be, you know, big cauldrons with rice and water boiling on them. There's an old saying that a monk's mouth should be like an oven. Aoyama Shundo, a contemporary Japanese Soto nun, wrote this. That mouth means the mouth of one's life. All kinds of experiences go into the mouth of one's life, including the things that we dread, such as the death of a loved one or one's own death. How are these unwelcome things to be burned? The firebox takes in anything. It has no likes or dislikes. It burns alike the smoothest wood and the thorniest branches in order to steam rice, cook vegetables. Joy, sorrow, failure, success, love, and hate all go in to the stove of life. So, how do we burn what life gives us for the benefit of all beings? A number of years ago, one of the founding members of the Mountain Rain Zen community, Jeannie Robinson, was diagnosed with biliary cancer. And Kate and I went to visit her on Bowen Island not long after her diagnosis. She said during our conversation, "Now it's my turn." And I don't think this was a statement of resignation. It was rather a clear seeing of her life at that moment, when an unexpected and unwelcome turn in life occurs. Can we say, now this too, now this too? And then, resting for a few breaths with whatever arises within us, then maybe we can respond. because despite all our efforts, we will never get life to work out on our terms, according to our plans. We will never avoid everything that we don't want or get our hands on everything we do. And nor will anybody else. In a sense, we all want contentment, we want health, we want to love, to be loved. And yes, we do envision differently the details and how all this may come into being. But underneath, you know, mostly we all want the same things. We are much more alike than different. And we can acknowledge this simple human truth. Everyone, just like me, wishes to have contentment, joy, and everyone, just like me, wishes to avoid suffering. The Dalai Lama suggests that we can cultivate and strengthen our equanimity by deepening our connection to humanity by bringing forward the thought, just like me, this person wants contentment, doesn't want suffering. Just like me, this person doesn't want stress and illness and misery. Just like me, this person wants comfort and safety and ease. And this, of course, can be done on our cushion, bringing to mind friends, acquaintances, those we work with, those we struggle with. Practice on both on and off the cushion brings us back again and again to the naked truth of our shared humanity, our shared heart. Let me end with this. Equanimity is like a great mountain, undisturbed by the weather, the mind clear and stable. Equanimity is like the vast ocean, holding the myriad creatures within it, accepting them all, the heart accepting and deep. Equanimity is like a furnace, transforming and using whatever is thrown in it. Thank you for listening.